All right. Fabulous. Good to see you all. Really wonderful. Everybody, I hope, as well. As we go through these different the stories in the first book of the Torah, in the book of Bereishis, it's just, I have such a difficult time picking just one topic to talk about. Every single story, really, it begs for more information. I know we've all seen the stories. Ami, I will never forget a conversation you and I had. It probably goes back now, probably pushing 20 years, certainly 15 years. You came to me, you used to come. I gave a Parsha class and you stopped coming. And I asked you, why'd you stop? I said, no, Rabbi, it's not you. It's just, I know the stories already. I want to do something different. Remember that?
Yeah.
And I said, you're right. It's the same story, but every time we learn something new about it, and it's it gives us greater depth and appreciation. I'll never forget that conversation.
That's right.
My favorite.
I remember.
So we read these stories, and I don't know about you, just it's an observation more than anything else. I find that after Simchat Torah, and we're all excited, we're going to get started from the very beginning again. And here we start the story of Bereishis, and it's about creation and Adam and Eve. And before you blink, we're in the story of Noah and the flood. And before you blink, we're already with Abraham and Sarah. And again, you blink one more time and you're with Isaac and Rebecca. And before you know, it's Yaakov. I can't believe that we're already at the story, starting already this week, going into this week, of where we're going to start with the brothers, with Yosef and the brother. I mean, it's like, how did this go so fast? I wish we could spend 4 months, 5 months, just on the book of Bereishis, just the first book of the Torah. We can go through Vayikra quickly. We're okay with that, you know. Skip all the sacrifices and that stuff. But there's so much to talk about. So I always have a difficult time. But I chose something. I hope it's meaningful to you. And I hope it'll generate some kind of conversation for us. I think the easiest way to start is in yesterday's Torah reading. In yesterday's Torah reading, we're told about the famous story about Yaakov, about Jacob. He's running away from his brother, Esau, because basically Esau swore that he was going to kill him for stealing the birthright and taking the blessings and all the stuff that Esau perceives as a wrong that has been done to him by Yaakov. So Yaakov has to flee. And he also was fulfilling the commandment of finding a wife, as his parents told him, to go find a wife. So what happens? He's traveling, he's running away, and the Torah tells us that he gets tired. The sun sets, and he has to lay down, and he goes to sleep, and he has the famous dream, the dream of a ladder that runs from the ground all the way up to heaven, and he sees angels that are going up and down on it, and he wakes, and God gives him a message, and he wakes up, and he says something phenomenal. What does he say? He wakes up, and he says, God promises I'll be with you. Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely Hashem is present in this place, and I did not know. And he became frightened. He said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of the heavens. Let's just let Justin in here, right? He comments, and he says, this is a unbelievable place. It's an awesome place. This is none other than the house of God. In Hebrew, he says, Ein zeh, this is not ki im beit Elokim. This is the house of God. Now, it's interesting. We all grew up with this concept that it's called the house of God. But Jacob is not the first one to make reference to this incredible place. In fact, if I were to ask you, tell me two other historical, or at least one major historical event that took place in this exact spot, in this exact place, you would tell me?
The Akedah.
Exactly. The binding, the story, the famous story of Avraham binding his son Yitzchak on Mount Moriah, right? This is where the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, takes place. And yet we don't even refer to it the way Avraham refers to it or how Yitzchak refers to it. Does anybody know what name Avraham gave this area? He gave it a name. You know it. If I say it, you'll say, "Oh, I knew that."
Amakom.
No, that's cheating. No, he gives it a real name. Come on, Rick. A real name.
Harabais.
You're close. You're very close. He does call it Har. He calls it mountain. He calls it Har HaMoriah or Hashem Yeraeh. This is where God revealed himself. But he calls it a har, a mountain. That's how Avraham perceives, and we're going to talk about this in a moment, but Avraham perceives this exact location as a mountaintop, which it is, which it is. However, Yitzchak, a little bit later, he refers to it differently. He refers to it as a sadeh, a field. Avraham calls it a mountain. Yitzchak calls it a field, and Yaakov calls it a house. This is not lost on our sages, the fact that each one of them identified with that special holy place with a different perspective. So let's take a moment and analyze this. And then the bigger question, once we come to the answer, is why is it that we refer to it like Jacob, like Yaakov? We always call it the Beit HaMikdash. The temple is called the house, the holy house. We don't call it the Har HaMikdash or the Sadeh Mikdash. We don't refer to it as the mountain that's holy or the field of holiness. It's always Beit HaMikdash. Even our synagogues, which are the mini temples that exist today, we call them Beit Knesset. We call them the houses of assembly, or the places that we learn Torah, we call Beit HaMidrash, the house of study. It's always with house. So I'm asking you a two-part question. Number one is, what is it unique that Avraham referred to it as a mountain? Yitzchak refers to it as a field. Yaakov refers to it as a house. And we follow Yaakov's example, and we go with that pattern of always referring to our sites of holiness as a house. That's my two-part question for now. What are your thoughts?
Well, we actually have buildings, whether it's a temple or a synagogue. It kind of resembles a house.
In what way does it resemble a house?
Four walls, roof.
Okay, hold on to that thought. Not lost on me. I got that. Let's take a step back. Let's ask, what is it that Avraham, as he referred to it as a mountain? Why don't we refer to our places like a mountain? What's an advantage and a disadvantage, or a pro and a con, when we perceive this place of holiness as a mountain? Brad, did you ever go mountain climbing?
Yes, but a mountain is so overwhelming. You know, a house is warming. It's your place, you know, your temple.
Beautiful, beautiful. A mountain has the pro, the advantage, that it's something you aspire to be like. You look up towards it. It's something of grandiose. It's really just, wow, It's something you aspire and you want to ascend to be high on a mountain. However, Brad is right, and that is, it can be overwhelming. It could feel out of touch with my day-to-day existence. It's hard for me, so to say, to live on a mountaintop, both physically and even conceptually. We want to grow. How many of us we went to shul on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and we made some kind of commitment in our heart that we're going to be better. And we meant it seriously. But here we are 2 months later, and how many of us are still at that high level? Not me, right? It's human nature. It's hard to live up on a mountain. to be on that high level. So yes, Avraham perceived it as a mountain, a place to ascend, to aspire to be like, but it's hard to live up there on that kind of high level. Maybe an Avraham can do it, but I'm not sure that the Tzvi's and the Amis and the Jims and the Craigs can all do that. It's hard. So there's a pro and a con. Similarly, with Yitzchak, he referred to it as a field. The positive of a field is that it's a place of growth. The natural inclination of a field is that which you nurture to produce something great. It produces. It's a product, right? It grows from a field. It's all about growth. But here also, it's something that I try to be. I try to be growth-oriented on a regular basis, but it lacks that certain warmth that Brad is talking about, that feeling of being inclusive. A field just goes on and on and on. My brother-in-law was a regional rep for a drug company many years ago. And his ended up, I guess he got the short straw. He ended up with the Northwest part of the states. So he used to drive through Wyoming and Idaho. And he told me that he's not exaggerating. He drove hundreds and hundreds of miles and there was nothing to see but open fields. It's a great area for growth. But it just goes on and on, and it's hard again to relate on a day-to-day basis. Yaakov, however, he sees holiness, this place that really epitomizes holiness on this earth, he sees it as a home. A home, as Jim correctly said, a home creates an environment. It has walls. It has a roof. It has a certain theme. It has different elements of where this is this mode. It's a more relaxing mode. I'm in my living room. My kitchen is more formal. I'm doing a lot of work. My study, it adds a certain dimension that I can relate to. They always say the difference between a house and a home is your home is you took your house and you made it your home. You made it this way. It's totally in your wheelhouse. Yaakov, he refers to it, it's an all-encompassing environment. It has the potential. See, I think this is really an important concept. Every year, as you guys know, I teach different classes throughout the region. Some on Zoom, some are in person. So there's been a class that I've been teaching on a pretty regular basis for now, almost, I want to say it's probably close to 13 or 14 years, been doing this class out in Frederick, Maryland. And so every year I pick a theme. Well, they've heard me speak for week after week after week, almost like you guys got stuck with me for many years, week after week. So I'm running out of material for these guys. So every year I have to think of a new theme. So listen to this. This year is what I chose, and it fits very nicely into our topic tonight. It's called Touring the Jewish Home. We're taking a tour of a Jewish home. And you say, okay, what exactly am I talking about? It's very simple. I've mapped out a curriculum where every single room in the house, I show what mitzvah can be done in that room. And we go from room to room to room to room, using it as an opportunity to talk about all the mitzvahs that we can do in our homes. So that ostensibly, when we go through every aspect of our home, you see how you can create a total environment that's Jewish, that has that Jewish value. That's the Jewish home. I really, truly believe that that is why we refer to it as base, as a house, like Yaakov did, because it really captures that all-encompassing environment. Does this make sense to you? Like, it has that element that is unique. Mountain is what to ascribe to be like. Field is what I try of being in that growth mode. However, a house has that intimate, warm feeling that I can relate to that encompasses everything. Let me share with you the following. we're all familiar that the very first house of God that we created was after the Exodus, after we left Egypt, right, Mark? We left Egypt and we come to Mount Sinai and we're given the Torah. And immediately thereafter, we're given the command to make the Mishkan, what's known as the tabernacle, the sanctuary that was the portable abode for God as we went through the 40 years in the desert, right? That was known as the tabernacle. But like every other important endeavor within the Jewish community, what did we need? What did we need to make it happen?
And they had to have a fundraiser.
A fundraiser, of course. We needed, this was the first building campaign in Jewish history. Yes. You think this is all new? Oh no, folks. This is 3,300 years old. This is old stuff. So they had their first building campaign. And the Torah tells us it was the most successful one in history. They collected everything they needed in a matter of days. Imagine, in days, they got it all. But here's what's interesting. There really were two campaigns. Most people don't know this. There really were two. One was for the structure itself, meaning they needed the gold and the silver and the copper and the different colored wools that were dyed. They had to make the tapestries and the ark and the table and the walls and all the for the physical building. However, there was a second, and that campaign was super successful. They got all that they needed in record time. However, there really was a second one, and that is for the various sacrifices that they needed on a regular basis. You know, the Torah tells us that the fire on the altar, on the Mizbeach, should never go out. You can't have a time of where you turn out the lights. It just doesn't happen. So you have to have something, whether it's wood or offerings or the extra that haven't been taken care of during the day. But there's always something. You have a regular need for collections for the public sacrifices that were brought regularly. Guess what? That campaign was a dud. That campaign was very hard. Imagine I come to you and I say, I have this amazing project. We're going to build something that it's amazing. So people want it. They'll want their name. They'll dedicate a room in memory of somebody. That's relatively easy. But if I say to you, I just need it for operational costs. You don't find people lining up to do that. It's not sexy. It's not cool. People don't, it's, well, you know, somebody else. I like that. Well, that's what happened in Jewish history. They needed to collect and the people didn't step up. Do you ever hear of the concept of where people donated every year a half shekel? The famous Machtzis HaShekel, the half shekel that they collected as part of the census. You know how many Jews were there? Well, it wasn't a one-time deal. It was every year. They donated a half a shekel. Everybody, rich or poor. Flat tax. Again, nothing new under the sun. Okay? Half shekel. That had to be a mandated because it wasn't cool. People weren't lining up to do that. Why? Because it really reflects human nature. Because people think that if it's the big showy, the big flashy, make a huge splash. That's what everybody's so interested. Let's go ahead and build this amazing building and we're going to have it in, and it's going to be the envy of the whole neighborhood. Everybody's going to say, oh, you remember that shul? That shul used to be in the basement and it was, but now, but for the operations, nobody likes to do that. But what we forget, gentlemen, is that it's the opposite. The building is absolutely worthless if there's no vitality inside it. What's the point of a building if there's never any services? If there's never any excitement, a program, an event? You're missing the point. We as the Jewish people sometimes get suckered and sucked in to the big grandiose big, and I don't mean to hit on it. But sometimes we lose the focus of what's really important. What gives that building life and vitality? It's the activities that take place. It's that the opportunities to transmit all the Jewish values that the building is there to help. The common heritage, our traditions, that's where it's all at. That's much harder to sell. The same is true in our homes. We don't have the tabernacle anymore. We don't have the temple anymore. But our homes are those miniatures. And it's what's in the home that makes all the difference. You can build a beautiful house and you can furnish it with all the most beautiful furnishings. And kol hakavod, enjoy it. Nothing wrong with that. But if you want it to reflect the Jewish values of who we are, then the inside has to be reflecting of that as well. We have to make sure that it's a thriving home, not just a house. It has to be a thriving Jewish home, permeating in every room of the home. This is perhaps the reason why the law is that when we put up a mezuzah, it's not only for the front door. It really belongs in every room in the house that one lives in, except the bathroom because it's not appropriate. But every room that we're living in, as opposed to a closet, I mean, but in your living room, your dining room, your kitchen, your bedroom, your study, your playroom, they should all have a mezuzah. Perhaps the reason behind it is because every room is permeated with the Jewish values. It should. This, I believe, is perhaps the reason why we make such a big deal about Yaakov referring to it as a house of God. Because that's what we can relate to. I want to add something else to this at the same time. When does Yaakov have this dream? At what point? We know he's running away, but where is he going?
Egypt, isn't he?
No, not on his way to Egypt.
Oh, Haran.
Good. He's on his way to Haran. Now, for all intents and purposes, he's being exiled. He was with his family in Israel proper, if we can call it that. Ultimately, we know that he doesn't really return. Ultimately, with the brothers and the fallout with Joseph and being sold to Egypt, ultimately, you're right, Irv. We end up in Egypt. This is the beginning of what we call galut. This is the beginning of the exile. Yaakov having to run away. Now picture the scene. Yaakov is running away. He's fearful of his life because Esav is going to come trying to come and get him. But he's also on a way to go build a family. And he is now gets a dream. And he comes to the realization that there is holiness, there is godliness in this place, but he doesn't refer to it as a mountain. He doesn't refer to it as a field, but rather a home. Where does that sanctity end up? It doesn't remain on a mountain. It doesn't remain out in the field. It gets transferred to every home. Going out into exile, one would have thought, we lose our connection to that holiness, that sanctity. Well, that's only for that time, only for that place. Wrong, says Yaakov. We have the ability to bring that sanctity where? Into our very homes. The highlight that we have to understand is that even going into exile, Yaakov hits on it and says, this is doable in wherever we are. Wherever we find ourselves, in Israel, outside of Israel, in Russia, in France, in America, it doesn't matter. If you have a home, it is an environment that God's presence can be brought into. That's a profound lesson that is lost if you refer to sanctity as a mountain or a field. It's only when we can refer to it as a home. But wait, let's take it further. What happened here? We're familiar with the story that Yaakov lays down to go to sleep, but he does something very strange. He takes stones and he puts it around his head. right? If you guys remember the story, he put stones around his head, as a protection. And the Torah tells us that he woke up in the morning and it was just one stone. Somehow they forged into one, and it has great symbolism of the 12 tribes becoming one entity. We're not going to go down that path, but it's an important idea. But why did he choose a stone? What kind of stone did he choose? The Torah doesn't tell us. It just says he chose stones and he put them around his head. But as I say to you all the time, if it's a piece of information recorded in the Torah, it's for a reason. The Torah could have just simply told us in the morning he woke up and he commented on the fact that this is a holy place. Why do we need this information about the stones that become one? What is so significant about that? So our sages dig deeper and say, okay, perhaps there's a greater significance. One particular midrash tells us that the stone that he chose, or the stones he chose, were actually the stones that were used on the altar, or for the altar that his father Isaac was bound on.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that. Think about that. I told you, we already established that this is the same place where Avraham bound his son Isaac on this place. Well, what did he bind him to? We know that it was a mizbeach, an altar. In those days, the altars were all made of stone. Says the Medrash that Yaakov chose the stones that were used by his father and his grandfather for the binding. And the Medrash moves on. Why is that significant? What would be the lesson for us that those are the particular stones Yaakov chose? What would you say? Remember, everything that we're being told here is we're supposed to distill from it a lesson. It's not just trivial information. So the next time you play Jewish Trivial Pursuit, you can get the last slice of your square, you know, whatever piece in your pie. It's there for a reason. What would be the significance? Jordy, help me here. What would be the significance? Why the Torah is telling us that it would be the stones that were from the binding of Isaac's Mizbeach, his altar?
I'm not sure. I don't know.
Maybe your dad could help. That was a hint, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's the starting of the bite. The bite started with Avram and Yitzchak, and it goes down the generations.
Okay, excellent. And exactly the point. And that is, this is a critical lesson for today's challenge about the next generation. How are we going to do it? The answer is, first and foremost, look back a generation. Look back two generations. We're not starting something brand new. We're continuing a tradition that started long before us. We're not the first Jews on the planet. We come from a long line of people who are committed to this tradition. The very first thing that Yaakov teaches us is that he's going to lay down, or when he wakes up, I'm not sure which one it was, but the stones that were used have a tradition. They have a past. I can go ahead and build my home, not because I decide this is the most important thing, but I have a tradition. My grandfather, my great-grandfather, my mother, I mean, we come from, this is what we have. If we go ahead, right? How can we, I don't want to use the word guarantee. There are no guarantees. But what can we do to make the odds in our favor that the children, the next generation, keep to our traditions, stay involved as active members of a Jewish community wherever they are? The first thing is that we set an example from our parents and our grandparents and our great-grandparents. It's the first thing that has to be done. Yaakov is about to go into exile, and he's able to survive it because he got the inspiration for the tradition from earlier generations. That perhaps is that significance, that he purposely chose the stones that were used in a previous generation. About, you know, sacrifice. That's what Yavram and Yitzchak did. But it gets better. The Medrash continues and says that he recited a prayer to God. What was the prayer? It's recorded now in the book of Tehillim, in the book of Psalms. It's one of the famous ones where we say, he says, Esa Einai El Haharim, I lift up my eyes to the mountains. Me'ayin Yavo Ezri, from where will come my help? Obviously, and then he continues, my help will come from God, etc. But it's such an incredible phrase. Esa Einai, I will lift up my eyes, El Haharim, to the mountains. Who am I going to pick on here? Jim, how do you say parents in Hebrew? Anybody?
Horim.
Horim.
Horim. Horim. So the Midrash is almost like a play on words. Esa Einai, I will lift up my eyes, El Haharim, to the mountains, can also be phonetically pronounced as I lift up my eyes, El Hehorim, to my parents. I turn back to my parents and see, Me'ayin Yavo Ezri, where will my help come from? When I look back and see that I'm part of a long chain of traditions. That is the very first step in how we create this Jewish home, is to recognize that we come from a line of traditions. And we have to obviously not just go through the motions of it. We have to learn what the traditions are. It can't just be robotic. The kids see right through that. But if it's meaningful to us, I had a great story the other week. We had some company for one of our Shabbat meals. And I do, you know, the way I do my Kiddush, I stand for one part, sit for the other. And then for Hamotzi, I do it a certain way. And it usually generates some kind of discussion and conversation with the guest. They're like, Rabbi, I've never seen that. Why do you do that? So I was ready to answer it. And one of my children said, oh, do you mind if I answer that? And I'm like, please, I'd be honored. I'd love to hear it, you know. And sure enough, she presented what she's heard. To me, that was the best. I don't care whether the guest got the message, but my kids got the message. That means they're listening. I don't know. Somehow over the years, something sunk in. It's the best because it's meaningful. It meant something to them. Okay. That's number one. It's not just the mountains. We look to our parents. In fact, maybe, all right, whatever. That's the first step. But I think if we take this a little further, you know, this class used to be a class in Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avos, we used to do Ethics of the Fathers. And it took us, I want to say 6 years, 7 years to go through all of it. And it was great. And I'm assuming that you guys remember every single word I said, so I don't have to repeat it. I'll just build on what it is we discussed. Craig, you get a bye for this. No problem, because you weren't there. That's fine. But here, I'll just refresh your memory of a Mishnah we did. The Mishnah is in the first chapter. The first chapter, Mishnah number 4, talks about two leaders, one named Yossi ben Yoezer, who was from the city of Tzreda, and Yossi ben Yochanan, who was the leader in Yerushalayim. And it tells, they say the following. They say, let your house be a meeting place for sages. You should sit in the dust of their feet and drink in their words thirstily. They taught three messages. Your house should be a place where sages gather. Number 2 is that you should sit in the dust of their feet. We'll explain each one in a minute. And then the third part is you should drink their words with a sense of thirst. One thing is clear. The three messages or the three lessons that he wants to convey have a certain theme. There's a commonality here. It's how do we go about to make, and that's the reason I chose this, is how do we make our homes Jewish homes? How do I do it? So they give a three-part answer. The first step, bring Torah into your home. Have sages. Well, what does that mean? Well, I know that, I'm sure some of you, I'm trying to remember, I did this, not sure I did it for anyone. Maybe you, Steve, I don't remember, maybe. But I used to do home groups, right? For those who lived further out and they couldn't come into the Kollel building, I used to drive out to Powell and to Worthington and all these other places. I used to go and I used to do a home group. I truly believe that's what this is saying. If you go ahead and you bring Torah into your home, you guys are all doing it by Zoom and you're letting me, I'm sure all of your family members are listening. Nobody has their headphones in. I know. Right? So they're all hearing this and you're bringing Torah into your home, but not on a once every couple of years. It's done with a sense of consistency. Torah is becoming part and parcel. Every 2 weeks, we have a Torah class in your home. Mark, this is in Atlanta. Steve, you're in where? San Francisco? I forgot already.
Yep, I'm in San Francisco.
I'm saying Torah is being broadcast in homes all around the country. That's how we do it. But also, the second part is you sit close to them. There's a sense of not just, just doing it as a check mark. I sit in the dust of their feet, meaning I want close proximity. I get involved. I have a question. I want to create a conversation about it. And then we take their words in with a sense of thirst, like you savor a glass of cold water after a great workout. You savor it. It's good. It's delicious. You drink it with thirst. So all this is very nice in the old days, but how do we make it practical today? So I think the first thing is, like we're doing, is that you're bringing Torah into your home with technology. I don't know about you, but I have absolutely seen an incredible explosion of technology that allows us to learn Torah. Any subject, any topic, any speaker, any language, it's literally a click away. I've never seen anything like it. When I was younger, it was tape, cassette tapes. They used to call them Torah tapes. They were the first thing that was out that I remember. They would put out, there was one fellow individual who every, I guess, week, month, whatever it was, he would put out a whole bunch of cassettes on Torah topics. And then it went to CDs, and then it was MP3 players, and then it was downloads, and now streaming. And there's literally, I'm not exaggerating, hundreds of thousands of Torah talks, anything in any topic of Judaism is a click away. Instead of driving, you drive 15 minutes to your office, for those who go to an office, not work from home, right? You have a 15-minute drive, 20-minute drive. For me, sometimes I have to drive out an hour and a quarter. So in the old days, I listened to music. Okay, I wasn't doing it. It's good, relaxing, right? So now I do half and half. I'll listen for a half and I'll find the Torah a topic and I'll stream it on my phone through the car. Apple Play. Great. So I spend half my time learning. That's how we can do it. Bring Torah books into your home. That's how you do it. But then don't let it gather dust. Use it. They tell a terrible story. I shouldn't say it. It's not a good story. There was a fellow in an old European town that passed away. He had a very bad name in the community. Really was not well liked. So they went to the rabbi of the community and they said, you have to officiate over his funeral. And he's like, what am I going to say? I got nothing nice to say about the guy. So he decided he would go visit his home. So he came, knocked on the door. They let him in, wanted to talk to them. And he sees bookcases like this, bookcases upon bookcases of Jewish books, of Svarim. He was shocked. He goes over to the bookcase and he's curious and he tries to pull one out and it doesn't come out. He's like, okay, I guess it's stuck. I don't want to mess with it. So he goes to the next shelf and he tries to pull the next one and no book came out. He's like, what's up with that? So the person in the house told him, oh, those aren't real. They're just wood cutouts that he painted. There was not one real Jewish book. It was just a show. We don't want that. Yes, have Jewish books in your home, whatever floats your boat, but have something and don't let it just sit there. Use it. Again, like I said, there's so much available to make it as a part of your home. Okay. But I believe that there's really a second aspect to this home. The first is the home that we live in. But we also call it, like I said before, we call it a Beit Knesset. The synagogue is called a Beit Knesset, a house of gathering. And the learning establishment are called Beit Midrash, place of study, house of study. Rabbi Stavsky, Olav HaShalom, told, I have it written down, he would talk about this concept. And I think he had it on this week's Parsha. He was talking about, again, Yaakov is fleeing from Esav. And after he has this dream, he's on his way, as Irv said, he's on his way to Haran. And the Torah tells us that the first thing that he encounters is a well. A well. And he sees the shepherds are all around and they're all schmoozing. Nobody's giving any drink to the flock. So Yaakov says to them, what's going on here? And they say, well, there's this big boulder that sits over the mouth of the well and we're waiting for more shepherds to come and we have to roll it off. And then, so fine. So Yaakov says, I'll help you. And sure enough, he rolls it off all by himself and he gives to drink all of the flock. And he's like, okay, everybody get back to work. And they're like, what are you talking about? He's like, Hain Om Hayod Gadol. The day is still good. There's still plenty of time left. Let's go. Come on. We got things to do. Let's be productive. Rabbi Stavsky took this story and he explained it. Yaakov, again, fleeing from Esav, comes to a be'er. He comes to a well. He quoted a midrash that said that the well is a Beit Knesset. It's symbolic of our shuls, our synagogues. Why? Because if you think about it, that's the place that is a fountain of knowledge. It's a fountain of connection to our spiritual side. Our synagogues is a fountain of our Jewish tradition. So it's not a stretch to think that that's symbolic of our synagogues. The well represents our synagogues, where people would come to hear the words of Torah, inspiration, right? Source of our tradition. And he gets there, and what's there? A big boulder blockage, as he called it. Boulder blockage. Sometimes the doors of the synagogue seem closed, intimidating for some, uninspiring for some. The doors are closed. There's a blockage. But don't worry. Hain Od Hayom Gadol. There's still time left. Rabbi Stavsky used to say, the day is not over. Hashku Hatzon. Give to drink the flock, the young ones, the next generation. Okay, maybe some of us weren't inspired at a certain point. I can tell you from my experience in Columbus and certainly here in my work here in Maryland and Virginia, there are a lot of people that didn't have an inspirationally exciting Jewish upbringing, either because Hebrew school was not exciting, their parents were already turned off after the Holocaust. There are a million reasons they didn't have it. And it's not a blame, and I'm not faulting anyone. It's just a reality. For them, there was a boulder blockage in front of that shul, in front of that synagogue. There was no connection, uninspired. But don't worry. There's still time because you have the ability to water the young sheep and have them partake of it. Have programs for the youth, Shabbos groups, outreach programs. I mean, this is what Rabbi Stavsky talked about. And he did it. He didn't just talk. He did it. You guys know better than I do what he did to create a vibrant Jewish community in Columbus, Ohio. I cite this all the time. I saw it with my own two eyes. There would be no way that I would have ended up in Columbus if not for a Rabbi Stavsky. There's no way to build an infrastructure where Torah Judaism is alive and well. It didn't just happen. Was there blockage? Of course there was. There were a million obstacles for him to get where he needed to go. They all thought he was nuts. He used to tell us that he got the job. You know how he got his job? How did he get the job at Beth Jacob? For one reason and one reason only.
He spoke Yiddish?
That is correct, because he spoke Yiddish. That's it. Not on his merits of a good speaker or whatever. It's because he spoke Yiddish and he can talk to them on their terms. And that was it. That was the turning point. And then from there, he took it and said, now we have to grow it and we have to reach out to the next generation. Many of you are the product of that reaching out to that generation. That's how it is. That's exactly the message here. We still have the ability to reach out and engage. That's the only way we stand a chance. I think Beth Jacob is a great example. And I do. I quote it all the time. My experience in Columbus, which was very much shaped by my relationship with Rabbi Stavsky. I don't know if he ever forgave me for turning down the assistant rabbi position, but I think we did okay. It was just, I read his stuff. I read his sermons, right? It's all about what are we going to do for the next generation? What are we going to do to build our homes, our physical homes where we live and our home called the Beit Knesset, right? Is that not the message, Eric, that you grew up with day in and day out?
That's right. He started.
I'm telling you, it's emblazoned in my head. And he's 100% right. And I think this is really the message that's being conveyed to us with this story, with the fact that Yaakov refers to it as a home, not as a mountain, not as a field, as great as those things are. And we should, try to ascend and to be like that. But at the end of the day, the buck stops at the house in our homes. What kind of home are we creating? How are we making this the most Jewish home that we possibly can? And it's not just the artwork, which plays a role. And it's not just the mezuzah. It's what we do in the home. How do we create this from room to room to room to room? And I'm literally this in my other class. I'm literally the first 2 weeks. I didn't even make it to the front door. You know that? The first 2 weeks, the first week I talked about the garden and the second week I talk about the porch. And then we talked about the front door. There's no place in your house, in your home that cannot be infused with that level of sanctity. There's a mitzvah to be done in every inch of your home because that is ultimately the only way we survive these exiles is we create an inner sanctum of holiness. I have a front door. Why? Because I don't only want to keep out the crime. I also want to keep out the schmutz. How do I translate that? All the dirt. You don't want the dirt from out in the street in your house. And it's not only the mud. It's also the values that are out there. Not all of them do I want in my house. But that's how I create a home. That's the only way. That, I think, is really the message of what it means to make a Jewish home. And I think that's really what Yaakov is referring to. Let me hear from you guys. What do you think? Add to what I'm saying. Question. Come on. Let's work with this.
We had a shir from Rabbi Moshe Ear last night at Shalosh Shittos. And I thought it was interesting. The topic he was talking about was Be'er Sheva. He said, Be'er is a spring, Sheva is seven. Seven represents Shabbos. And he says, the Shabbos is a spring that powers the rest of the week. And that was his message.
It's a great idea. It's a great concept. But you can use that now. I mean, I'm going to steal it. I'll use it for something else. But that should become... No, but Rick, you're right. Because if you think about it, it's... Your Shabbos isn't just, I grew up thinking Shabbos was the end of a week. It was the end of the week, but it's not. It's really only half the story. It is the end of the week, but it is the beginning of setting the tone for the next week. How you conduct yourself on this Shabbos will have an impact on how the next 6 days are going to go. It's 100% true. And the way you do Shabbos and the way you do kosher and the way you give tzedakah. I mean, I'll give you another example. Just right before the class, there was a knock at my door and there was a fellow collecting, right? So my kids already know the whole routine and we take them in and fine. But I remember as a kid, I'm sorry, I remember when my kids were much, much younger. A fellow would come and I would write a small check, nothing of great significance. But the kids would say to me, can I give him the check? We tried to, in their minds, it was yes, they're giving tzedakah. They're the ones giving it. Yeah, I wrote the check. It was my checking account. I will tell you that. But in their minds, this little 7-year-old, this little 5-year-old, he or she was giving tzedakah to this fellow. And it's exactly what I wanted them to walk away with. They should have it. I'll give you an example. It's just coming to me now. You got me started, Rick. It's all your fault. Go back to the very beginning where the three angels come to visit Abraham. You guys remember that story? Three angels come visiting. So what does Avram do? He and Sarah prepare food for them. So listen to what the Torah says. The El HaBakar Ratz Avraham. Avraham ran to the cattle. Vayikach ben bakar, and he took a young cattle, rach v'tov, young and good, vayitain el hanar, and he gave it to the youth, he gave it to the lad, vayimaher la'aso so, and he quickly hastened to prepare it. Rashi says, who's the kid? Who's this young kid? I mean, the Torah doesn't give us his name. Who was it?
Ishmael.
It was Ishmael. That's correct. It was his first son, Ishmael. Jimmy asks Rashi, why is the Torah telling me that he gave it to Ishmael? Whoop-de-doo. Is that critical to the story? Doesn't seem to be, because he doesn't appear anywhere else in the rest of the story. This is the one sentence, the three words. And he gave it to the youth and he hurried to prepare it. Why? Says Rashi, two words. Rashi gives us two words, lechancho b'mitzvot, to educate him on how to do a mitzvah. This was Avraham in parental mode. I can sit here, Yishmael, and try to tell you about the mitzvah known as hachnasat archim, of inviting guests and taking care of guests. I can sit and lecture you. I can give you all the sources and tell you how wonderful it is. But you know what? It's not going to mean diddly until I get you involved. He physically got Ishmael involved. That's how we can do this. And that's the only way. My kids know come Friday, there are certain things that they have to do to get ready for Shabbos. One of my daughters prepares the candles for my wife. One of my daughters is in charge of making sure that the dessert is taken care of. My job is to make the chillin. We all have jobs. I can sit here and just say, oh, okay, we'll take care of it. No. If you engage them, involve them, then it's a whole different story. That's how we create that in the home. So, Rick, I'm using your example in terms of Be'er Sheva, that it's setting the tone for the rest of the week, the way I'm going to prepare for Shabbos, put in what is important to me on Shabbos. Listen, I'm all in favor of having a Shabbos meal together with our families. Absolutely. But what do we talk about at that table? Are we just catching up on the latest Buckeyes? Are we talking about the latest crash in the stock market? Like, what are we talking about? Do we even mention anything Jewish? That will determine what the kids and what we walk away with. What is our Shabbos meal? Is it just a family dinner? You can, if it works out for others, you know, Tuesday night is better than Saturday, Friday night. It's just more convenient. I'd rather do that. Then it's just a regular family dinner. But if it's on Friday night or Shabbos lunch, then it takes on another dimension of sanctity. If you make it holy, do something. It doesn't have to be only, you can talk Buckeyes. I'm okay with that. Especially if they win, right? Only, but it shouldn't only be that. We have the potential to turn our houses into homes, Jewish homes. That is the message that I want you to walk away with tonight.
Question, Rabbi.
Please.
I know you need a quick question every once in a while. It seems like one of the fundamental qualities first of all, it seems like you don't build a mountain and you don't build a field. You only build a house. And they talk about the house and a home, and sometimes it's the house of Israel, but not the home of Israel. We never refer to ourselves as the home of Israel,
right?
Which is interesting. Something we build ourselves, I guess. But there seems to be an underlying quality necessary for the other three things to do, to welcome sages into your house, to clean the dust off their feet. And what was the third one?
To drink thirstily from their words.
To drink. It's like, it's all requiring humility. Like, yes. I don't know anything. I invite sages in. I'm willing to clean their feet and drink their words. And so somehow there's a notion of humility is necessary fundamentally to build a home.
I think that's an excellent point. I just want to add, it's interesting you say that, because here, if I want to go ahead and let's say we decide we're going to go take a field trip and we're all going to go to the Sinai Desert and we're going to go find Mount Sinai. Let's assume we can get there. Okay. Are we allowed to go up the mountain, up Mount Sinai today?
Yeah.
Yes?
No, yeah. It's in Egypt now.
I'm not asking from a legal standpoint about U.S. authority. Let's assume we have permission to go there. Can I, one second, Jeff, you're telling me it's okay.
I've been up there. I've been up the top of Mount Sinai.
Okay.
There you go.
So wait a second. How come you're allowed to do that? But it's a question about whether I can go up on the Temple Mount.
Well, the funny thing is, when you get to the top of Mount Sinai, you look around and say, see these other hills? Those could all be Mount Sinai too. But
no, but seriously, let's assume it's the right one. Halachically speaking, from a Jewish law, am I allowed to go up on Mount Sinai today? The answer is 100% yes. It retains zero sanctity. When God left and we moved away from Mount Sinai after getting the Torah, it has zero residual sanctity. Yet the Temple Mount, even after the destruction 2,000 years ago, retains the holiness. That's why we pray at the Kotel. That's why, according to many authorities, you can't go up on the Mount, on the Temple Mount area. It retains a certain level of sanctity that we're not privy to yet. So I'm asking you, what's the difference? Why does Sinai lose its sanctity and the Temple Mount does not? The answer is what Steve Ellman said. And that is, we created the sanctity where the temple is. We were a partner with God in that. It's where Avraham showed his dedication to God, where Yitzhak showed his dedication to God, where King Solomon built the temple. We were active participants in that being a holy site. Sure, we got a head start. It was already a holy site because God dedicated that way. But we were active participants. Mount Sinai, all we did were passive. We were passive. We received the Torah. We were asked, do we want it? And we said, yes. But we did not actively participate in the giving of the Torah. We were recipients. And just to build on that point, Steve, create the home. You are active participants. Your home has sanctity. Why? Because you're Jewish. But you build it. You make it. That's different than Sinai. That's why it's more like the Beit HaMikdash than it is the Sinai.
Is that why the rocks fuse together? Because Jacob did it himself?
Maybe. I love that. Rabbi Soloveitchik is the one who I learned this from. I read it in one of his books. He talked about this concept between Sinai and the temple, and it came down to that point where we are active participants and we make it a part of it. That retains its sanctity forever. That's special. In fact, the Talmud says that all of the synagogues over history, even the ones that have been destroyed, will ultimately, when Mashiach comes, will ultimately find its place back in Israel. Why? Why? It was destroyed. The answer is because when we built that place of sanctity, it is going to remain forever. Physically, it's gone now, but it never will lose its sanctity. Never.
So a mitzvah lives forever and your avarice die?
Always. Mitzvah live forever. Absolutely. I don't know about you, but I can't sleep after I teach this class. I am stoked.
Thank you.
Any other thoughts?
It gets you ready for the next week. This makes my week. I mean, it gives me the willpower, right? It just energizes you.
Good. I mean, I'm totally stoked. Usually, I don't teach this late at night anymore, but I was like, this is great. My wife knows Sunday night she goes to bed before I am. There's no way. There is no way. I am stoked for the next 4 hours. It's a good thing there's Sunday night football.
It's late. It's over.
Right.
Anyway. Great. Any other thoughts, comments? If not, we'll pick this up in a couple of weeks. Where's my phone?
Sounds good.
Let's just take it from here. What's in 2 weeks? Let's just take a look here. 1 second. Yeah. Just want to make sure.
2 weeks.
Is the it'll be Hanukkah.
First night of Hanukkah. Ooh. Hold on. And then 2 weeks later, that's another good question. What about January 1st? You guys are going to be sober by then?
Still have to wait.
The Buckeyes will have gotten their clocks cleaned, probably, so we'll be able to learn some
tomorrow. So I'm going to have to get you guys all out of your depression.
We need a debar, yes. Tara. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
that's right.
I'll have to find something a little bit more uplifting and non-depressing. So fine. So is the first night of Hanukkah going to be a problem? I mean, I don't know. 7.
What's the date?
19th.
The 18th, yeah.
Yeah, 18th. Same.
Sounds good. Yeah.
Unless. Oh, you guys aren't going to be available the 25th either. Oh man. All right. Well, I guess let's try. Let's try for the 18th. Let's keep it for 2 weeks. Let's see. Let's try to do. We'll talk about Hanukkah. I'll tell you that ahead of time. We'll pick something to talk about Hanukkah, and then we'll stay on schedule. I should be back.
Okay.
I have an event from like 5:45 to 7. Ooh. I should be back by 9.
Great.
Okay, fine. So let's keep it for the 18th, and we'll meet then. We'll talk about Hanukkah.
All right.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.